Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August the 21st, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is Christy Trainus Session, Christianity and Childhood, Religious Literature for Children, number 99-5. Let's listen in.
And have been childhood in the Western Christian tradition. We've been talking in our project about important theologians and what they've said about children, but I've also become interested as a parent in what kinds of literature our children get and what it says about children, what it says to children, and how it interprets the scripture and the religious tradition. This is not going to be comprehensive. There are probably neat texts that you know about that I won't talk about, and classic children's Bibles that you grew up with that I won't even mention. But I wanted to give us kind of an overview of how children's Bibles have changed, what they've included, etc., and other religious literature for children. The rest of the week, I've done a number of other things. I have a reading list that I just made up to cover all the topics, which I've got here. And a number of the books on it, although not all of them, are in the Holden bookstore, and they've asked me to remind you about them, so I'm going to. One of them is by Robert Coles, which is on the spiritual lives of children, kind of a classic, actually, in the last couple of decades. Robert Coles interviewed hundreds and hundreds of children with the help of his wife and sons over a long period about their spiritual lives, and did this not sort of cold, but by getting to know the children over a long period of time, developing an intimate connections with them. And the book is about not only the children's spiritual lives, but about his journey as a psychoanalyst, struggling to give up all of those, Freudian and more than Freudian assumptions about the non-reality of religion. You know, when people talk about God, they don't really mean God. There's something about their ego or their sexual drive or something, and that's just a false language. He was struggling to give that up in the course of the project, and so it's a very, very interesting reading and worth having. Another book that is there that I haven't talked directly about, but I asked them to get simply because I and a number of people that I know have found it so fruitful, is called For Fidelity, and it's by Catherine Wallace. It's about how we can take our experiences as married or non-married people to help us talk to our children, our grandchildren, other people we know about the importance of fidelity and about developing a healthy sexuality. It's neatly divided. It's very readable. It draws a lot on personal experience, and yet it also draws a lot on the Christian tradition and scriptures in a very comfortable way, in very familiar language. It's a neat book, and I recommend it. Finally, I'll be talking about Sandy Sasso's books today. She's actually a Jewish author. She was the first, I think she was the first Reformed rabbi, female rabbi. And she has written a number, she kind of turns out one child's book annually over the last several years. A couple of her books are in the bookstore, and if there is anybody you buy books for baptismal presents or communion presents or whatever it is, I recommend looking at them because they're just marvelous. She has terrific illustrators, and she does wonderful things with the biblical text and with helping children to understand the idea of God. One that I'm not going to talk about today because I forgot to bring my copy, and that's over there, is called God in Between, and it's about finding God in connections between people. And since that's something that we spend a lot of time doing at Holden, that might be one you want to look at. Okay, I'll start and we'll let people come in as they will. I'll put the reading list over here. And in fact, I'll just pass it because I don't have it. Feel free to take more than one because this is my last day on kids, so I'm not going to run out. Now, children's Bibles are interesting because very few of them are really Bibles. I mean, they're not the full biblical text, right? So that we give them that name is meant to give them the authority of a Bible, but they're not really. And so the question is, so what kind of books do they become? And I'll be talking a little bit about that. They're interesting in that they either select texts or they paraphrase texts or both. And all of you know from your own biblical study or from attending Jan Otto's Bible studies last week or from Bible studies at church at home that any paraphrase or any extract is an interpretation, okay? It's not the raw text. It's the raw text explained in some way. And especially in children's Bibles, the choice of texts and the way that they're presented and the pictures that are put with them, very important, are intended to steer the children in a particular interpretive direction. This is necessary, this is inevitable, especially the Old Testament. It's impossible to present to children without this because in many of the narrative parts of the Old Testament don't interpret anybody's behavior. They simply say, this happened, and then that happened, and he did this, and she did that, and then they went there. You know, there's no explanation of why it's important. Now, as we know, if you're Jewish growing up reading the scripture, you're also learning the interpretive tradition, which explains all of this. But Christians don't have this canonical interpretive literature, and so all through history we have to invent our own interpretations. Children's Bibles have a history. And one of the most fascinating books on this that I've ever run into, probably the only history of children's Bibles actually, is Ruth Bodekheimer's book, and it's on your list. It's not in the bookstore. I didn't think it would be of wide enough interest to put it on the list, but on the bookstore list. But it is fascinating, and if you're interested in this at all, I really recommend you're going and getting her book out of the library. Its one fault is that it doesn't have enough pictures. And we all can guess why, because the publisher didn't want to spend the money to print them. But it's really an interesting read, and if this sparks your interest at all, I'd read it. One of the myths we need to get out of our head, and it was a myth that was in my head until I read her book, was that in the 16th century, people didn't read the Bible. That this was one of Martin Luther's complaints, that they didn't read the Bible. Well, not really. The 16th century was an era of very high interest in the Bible among everybody, okay? And contrary to the short version of the Martin Luther story that we sometimes get told, there were vernacular Bibles available. The problem was not that there weren't vernacular Bibles available, but they were based on the Vulgate. Now, does anybody know what the Vulgate is? Yeah.
The Latin. Okay.
It was the Latin Bible. Now, the farther your translation gets from, the more steps removed your translation gets from the original, the more inaccuracies and problems get into it. So what happened was you had the Greek and the Hebrew. They were translated into the Latin Vulgate, and then people were translating the Vulgate into German, English, or whatever it was. Okay. Now, so we had vernacular Bibles based on the Vulgate. What Luther did that was interesting and original was go directly back to the Greek and Hebrew. Okay. But there were vernacular Bibles around. However, there were very few complete vernacular Bibles. Why? Well, how did you reproduce a book in the early 15th century? By hand, right? That takes a very long time. And the longer it takes, the more expensive the book that you produce is going to be. So if you want to put the scriptures into the hands of anybody but people who live in monasteries, you know, where these books can be found in libraries, you have to pick and choose your texts. So the beginning of the paraphrase tradition and the beginning of the excerpt tradition simply comes out of the need to the desire to put the biblical text in people's hands. And if you want to do that, you've got to shorten it up. And so that's how we started, paraphrasing and choosing little pieces. These were intended for people who wanted to have some biblical texts in their homes, who maybe were new in the faith. And so children and adults would read the same kinds of paraphrases and collections. These began, however, to go in two different directions. The idea of developing a paraphrase of the text that would interpret it and tell the story more succinctly, more briefly, okay? And this was the main way of doing it, of condensing it, up until Martin Luther came along. Well, why would Martin Luther not like paraphrases? Anybody know why he wouldn't want a paraphrase text?
Too biased.
Well, it's biased, right? He wants people to go directly to the Word of God. But yet, he's not expecting people to get the whole Word of God, because that would be expensive and impractical. So what he wants to do is go through and cut out pieces, right? And do a kind of cut and paste version, so that they get exposed directly to the Word of God. Now, when he made his versions for families, he would cut out stories and not even bridge them together. They would just be cut out and put together with illustrations. The interesting thing is that Martin Luther became very anxious about people reading unadorned and uninterpreted biblical texts without guidance. Does anybody know why? Does anybody know why he got very nervous about people reading the Bible without help?
Well, the enthusiasts knew the ones that were contemporaneous with him that kind of go on.
Right. People took the Bible into their own hands, and Martin Luther assumed that when they read it, they would all, of course, reach agreement on what it meant. In fact, they didn't. And so you have the Anabaptists going off and refusing infant baptism, which was so important to Martin Luther. Some of the Anabaptists, contrary to the way they are today, were quite violent and wanted to overthrow the government. There were people, peasants who got hold of this, who thought this meant that they ought to have, that God's Jubilee ought to come to them now, and they revolted. Martin Luther wrote strongly against that, so he actually got quite nervous about people reading the unabridged Bible, and he wanted to pick out texts that he thought would be edifying and train people in the proper direction. When printing evolved, it became much more possible for scripture to be spread around, but this didn't stop the paraphrase and excerpt tradition. Kept going on. And what is very, very interesting about this, and I'm not going to go through the whole history of it, but what's very interesting about this is what texts do people choose to put in, and what meanings do they give them? And it turns out that this is widely divergent. Okay? For instance, Roman Catholics, as most of us know, haven't tended to think of, historically, of the ideal life as the family life. The ideal life was the celibate life, right? The life of the single person devoting their entire energy to prayer and virtue. And so when they told the stories of biblical parents and children, they left all the mucky parts in, okay? They left in all the parts where parents behave badly, you know, in all the parts where children are revolting. Now, what happens in the Protestant Bibles, the Protestant sort of paraphrases and excerpts, is that they leave out the parts where the parents behave badly. Why? Because they don't want bad parental models in the Bible. Well, it turns out that, for instance, David does some pretty horrific things. Like, anybody remember?
Taking other people's wives.
Taking other people's wives, right? killing their husband and killing the husband, right? Exactly. What does anybody know the story of David and Absalom? Anybody able to remember that enough to tell a story? You want to do that for us? Do you remember the story well enough to?
David, sure. Coffin, meeting David.
Right. Okay.
Domestic conflict.
Right. Now, why did David and Absalom come into conflict? What's the initial offense? Okay. Absalom is David's son. Right. Tamar is David's, is Absalom's full sister. Amnon is their half-brother. Amnon rapes Tamar. David does nothing. Absalom is furious. Because David does nothing, Absalom takes justice into his hands, right, and kills Amnon and is then banished. Right. That sets up the conflict between David and Absalom. The desire by Absalom to unseat his father David. Now, fascinatingly, many children's Bibles leave that out of the story, and then when Absalom, they just start with Absalom revolting against David. No explanation. Then Absalom becomes the disobedient son, and David becomes the betrayed father. Right? In the beginning of the story, Absalom and Tamar are the betrayed children, and David is at fault. Let me just leave that out. And one of my favorite ways of looking at children's Bibles is to pick a story, a troublesome story, and lay them all out on the table and see how each one handles it. It's fascinating to see what happens. In the 18th century, most of the sexually explicit texts, the rape of Dinah, the Levite and the concubine, which is a horrifying text, just absolutely, I think it's probably in Phyllis Trible's text of terror, where she takes the Bible and shows the texts that are very difficult to deal with, especially for women. Because the ideology of childhood innocence made these discussions inappropriate. Children weren't supposed to know about sexuality. They weren't supposed to know about any kind of violence except the kind that restored justice, you know, and showed that God is on our side. So all of these start to disappear. Remember that what we now think of as children's Bibles early on were people didn't make any distinction between children and sort of ignorant adults, right? And it was in the 18th century that people began to realize what children needed was different from what ignorant adults needed. And so those texts diverge, and that's another reason why these sexually explicit texts start to fall out of the Bible. Also, and I don't have proof of this, but Ruth Bodekheimer has looked at them, she says that the choice of the texts that go into a children's Bible actually tends to be driven by what texts have been in previous children's Bibles. So the authors of children's Bibles don't sit down with the Old and New Testament and read through and think, wow, that would be a great story to put in, and let's put in that story. They think, well, let's see, all children's Bibles have the story of Abraham and Genesis, the creation, and they have the story of Noah and the story of Moses, so I better tell all those stories. They don't all go back and look and see what's there and ask. It's difficult to imagine the power that the way in which excerpts are done and the way in which they're arranged has in the way a children's Bible affects a child. But this is an astonishing and extreme example, so I don't want you to think all these are as extreme. But some people have felt that children's Bibles should be excerpts. All right? Well, here is a children's Bible that is excerpts. This comes from a section of the Bible called Things Jesus Would Have Learned from His Mother Growing Up, I think. Something like that. This is from the early 20th century. It's the Cambridgeshire Children's Bible, which was put together for school children in Cambridgeshire in England. And what I want to show you is the power of how these texts are arranged. This is excerpts, but look at how they're arranged and the subtitles that they have. I apologize for its smallness. Here we are. The woman and the children's food. Give us this day our daily bread. Two women shall be grinding together. The one shall be taken and the other left. Okay, this is women and food. Anything that has to do with women and food goes in this category. If God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? This is called heating the oven. I'm not sure I wouldn't have gotten that interpretation out of that. Okay, making the bread, obviously something women do, even though women aren't mentioned. The children's food, if a son shall ask of any of you that is a father, will he give him, ask bread of any of you that is a father, will he give him a stone? Women aren't even in there, that's fathers, and yet it's under the woman and children's food, see? The five barley loaves, the sparrows and the farthings. She answered and said unto him, yes, Lord, let the dog, yet the dogs under the table eat of the children's crumbs. So this is women and food. Okay, they're to think of women and food together because of these. These are biblical texts, you know, nothing added, right? And then the woman's duties, all right? Lighting a candle, sweeping the house, and seeking diligently, a woman's duty. Lighting a candle again, okay, and put it on a candlestick, not under a bushel, but a light to give light to the house. This is woman's job, lighting the house. Okay, not what the text is meant to say, is it? We're to think of ourselves as people giving light to others because of the light of Christ. And this says, no, the reason that we have this passage in the Bible is that women are supposed to take care of the candles and lamps. Okay? No one also seweth a piece of new cloth on an old garment. Women sew. Okay? Jacob's well. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. A woman's job is to give to drink. Now this story is about Jesus choosing a woman to proclaim the gospel to the Samaritans, right? This amazing thing that he does, choosing a woman. They take the story and make it into a story about how women are supposed to serve food and drink to other people. Okay? Oh, but it's just the biblical text. So it's a wonderful example of how excerpting the text and arranging it with these titles changes the text radically.
Gives you the feeling it was done by an idiot when we cut curtains. Doesn't it? I mean, you sort of pick the word, and if it shows up, oh, well, we'll use that.
Right.
Without actually thinking about what's there.
Right. But with a very strong ideological bent. Very, very strong.
Probably unrealized, though, I suppose.
Right. And,
I mean,
and we all.
Yeah.
Exactly. And in about 30 or 40 years, people are going to look at the contemporary children's Bibles that I'm going to pass around in a few minutes and think, oh, God. You know, they have this ideology of X that we don't even see in them. Another marvelous way is through the illustrations. Now, think about these figures. In France, in the 16th century, only 20% of books were illustrated. 20%. It was just too extravagant to, when you're talking about the kinds of printing presses they had and the kinds of effort it would take to make the plates, to put illustrations in books. But of the illustrated books, 83% were religious. Okay? So the putting of pictures in religious texts to help us interpret the text was a priority. But I want to give you some examples of differences in illustration. Let's look at this bottom one first. This is from I'm sorry it's so blurry. I'm got it just about as good as I can, I think. This is from a very, very early, I think it's late 16th century text. We have the serpent touching the tree of life. Those of you who are with Jan Otto this week have learned about the significance of that. The serpent is touching the tree of life saying, see, it didn't hurt me. You can do it too. Now, if you're in the picture and you're God, which side is Eve on?
In the picture. She's
on the left side. And Adam is on the right. Who sits at the right hand of God?
The new Adam.
Right. And who sits at the left? The damned. Right? And for a very long time, this was the way Adam and Eve were depicted. Eve very carefully placed on the left, if you're in the picture, right, if you're God. And Adam on the right, intended to imply that the fault lies with Eve and the hope lies with Adam. Now, and see, the serpent is fairly small here. And they're surrounded by animals, trees. They're in a fairly protected spot. This one comes from a tradition of depiction of the tree of the fall that apparently was very popular around World War II. What's dominating this picture? The serpent. And around World War II, apparently, the idea of the serpent being an all-encompassing, all-surrounding evil, that is sort of society as evil, right, dominates some of these illustrations. Eve is tiny, right? She's not really reaching for that apple. That apple, she's sort of standing there looking very scared and small, and this enormous apple is about to drop into her hands. All right, Adam is nowhere to be seen. And the serpent, it looks as though he's threatening her, forcing her to take it, right? A very different understanding of her role in all of this, of the power of evil and of human agency. A child looking at this is not going to get the same understanding of the story at all that a child looking at that first picture is going to get. All right. The Binding of Isaac. Here's a pretty traditional one. Usually in these pictures we have, this is not very clear, we always have the ram caught in the bushes, Abraham with a menacing knife, usually raised, actually it's lower here than it would normally be, the angel interceding, Isaac obediently kneeling, right? And a clear altar. So we have the and the sort of bemused Abraham. Oh, you don't want me to do this? You know. This can be a very disturbing picture because most children wouldn't like to think of their faithful fathers murdering them, right? But the focus is on the faith of Abraham and the steadfastness of the angel. So the agent here, the focus of the picture, is Abraham. Isaac is sort of one of the props. Okay? This is from a very contemporary children's Bible. The sacrifice part is not pictured. What we have is Abraham gratefully embracing his son. It's the, oh my gosh, you're all right, right? Isaac being comforted, Abraham looking almost chagrined, okay? Grateful to have his son back. Very, very different picture. Okay. See, I think I have another. Oh! Story of David and Bathsheba. If you read it, there is no intimation at all that Bathsheba is displaying herself to David. Okay? David is the interloper. He has looked at her taking a bath, and he sends for her, right? But she didn't ask for this. All right. Very early on, we begin to get this kind of illustration. I'm sorry it's so blurry. But here is Bathsheba. Here is David. He's looking out his window, and she's going like this. Okay? This is not in the story. But in this case, it becomes the woman's fault, you see, because she's displaying herself to David, tempting him. All right? Now, interestingly enough, this comes up into the present day in biblical texts that present it in children's Bibles. Here's Bathsheba, and the picture is not very good, but you can see here's David. She's looking sideways at him as she unhooks her dress. Okay? And this is not in the text. But if David is such a great guy, then someone must have tempted him if he was going to fall. Right? And so it becomes Bathsheba's fault then that David that David asks her into his home and then goes off and kills Uriah. It's not entirely her fault, but she's the occasion of the sin. Right? Very, very interesting. And when we have pictures of Potiphar, when we have pictures of Susanna, they're always displaying themselves. That could be gotten out of the text with Jacob and Potiphar, but you can't get it out of Susanna in the book of Daniel. Susanna, again, is just like Bathsheba, innocently taking a bath in her place where she's supposed to be protected, and these guys are leering over, right? And yet she's often depicted as being the one who's displaying herself. There are some interesting word choices. Let's see. I'll read a few of those. How much more time do we have? In a little bit. If we have time. There's fascinating insertion of evaluative judgments. As I said, especially in the Old Testament, we get the story. We don't get a judgment about who's right or wrong. But there's often a very careful juxtaposition. For instance, Isaac, obedient, lives. Absalom, disobedient, dies. Obey your parents, or something may happen. Okay. Noah. Fascinating because the story of Noah is used to many different purposes in children's Bibles. Now, most of the time, when we tell the story of Noah to our children, what do we end with?
The promise of the rainbow.
The promise of the rainbow. So in here, God blessed Noah and his family, saying, "Behold, I will make a promise to you and all who come after you, that I shall never again destroy all life with a flood. And as a sign of this promise, I shall set a rainbow in the clouds. So whenever a rain cloud passes and a rainbow appears, it will be a sign to me and to you and to all who come after you that I remember my promise and shall not send another flood." Then we get the rainbow. The next thing is the Tower of Babel. What happens after the rainbow in the Bible? Anybody remember? What happens after the rainbow? He builds an altar, and he also plants. One of the things he plants is what? A vineyard. Right? They've been on the ark all this time. No wine. They plant a vineyard. They make a wine. First thing Noah does is he goes and gets roaring drunk. Okay? Roaring drunk. He's so drunk, he sort of passes out. He's naked in his tent. His son goes in and looks at him. Oh, Dad's naked. Now, the fascinating thing is that the way in which this is interpreted changes. Okay? At first, everybody leaves that part of the story in. And they say, the point of this is, don't get drunk. Look how Noah disgraces himself. Stage two. And this comes in around the time of the Reformation, when parents are supposed to be revered and obeyed by their children. Oh no! Noah just had a momentary lapse. Of course he'd had a year of abstinence. He went and had some wine. The problem is that Ham looked in on him and then told everybody he was naked. How disrespectful of Ham to do so. Children, do not disrespect your parents or criticize them. Okay? And then stage three is, of course, just get rid of that part of the story. Okay, which is the one that I read to you. But that's not always the way it's been in children's Bibles. There are three different lessons that can be learned. One, you know, end with the story of God's faithfulness and don't even tell it. Tell the part about Noah getting drunk. One is don't get drunk, and the other one is if your parents get drunk, don't disrespect them. very different lessons that are taught. Here's a Bible. Called The Story of the Bible, and it was written by a man who did a fair amount of research on the text, as much as you could do in the early part of the century, and wanted a thinking children's Bible, you know, one that would sort of look down its nose at all the unexplained mysteries and explain as many of the mysteries as possible. And here's what he does with Jacob. He's talking about, Jacob has finally paid off Rachel and Leah. Even then he was at the mercy of his mother's relatives. He had no flocks of his own and could not set up a household of his own. Remember how he got into the wilderness was that he deceived his father and took his brother's birthright. So we already have many strikes against him, okay? Once more, he made an agreement with Laban. He would work for 7 more years. Then he'd receive all the black lambs and the spotted and speckled goats which happened to be found on Laban's lands. This would give him a fair start toward independence. Laban says, well, you hardly get any black goats, black sheep. Well, this is easy. Sure, I get 7 more years of free labor. It was a game of wits between uncle and nephew, but in the end, the nephew proved to be the sharper of the two because Jacob was really a very good shepherd. He understood his business and had learned a good many tricks. He knew how to change the food and water of his flock so as to increase the number of certain strangely colored goats and sheep. Laban, on the other hand, who left most of the farm work to his sons and his slaves, was not familiar with these new methods of husbandry, and before he knew what was happening, Jacob had gained possession of most of his herds. Then he grew very angry, but it was too late. Jacob had gone, snuck off in the night. No, he'd taken all his black lambs with him and all of his spotted speckled goats and his 2 wives and his 11 children, and for good measure he'd forced his way into the deserted house of Laban and had stolen the household goods which belonged to his father-in-law. Then we have a sad story of Rachel dying in childbirth and the dissension between Rachel and Leah, etc. And very sad homecoming. He's now an old man. And Jacob, who now called himself Israel, he inherited his father's estate and settled down to enjoy the fruits of a career that had been based entirely upon fraud and theft. Such a life, however, is rarely a success. Before very long, Jacob was once more forced to leave his old home and spend the last of his life in the distant land of Egypt, far away from the graves of his ancestors. Jacob is not a revered patriarch here. He's an example of all what you don't want to be. And it says, aha, sin gets its own reward. Don't be like Jacob, the deceitful guy who made his living, you know, sort of nosing in on everybody else's rights. If he'd been a good boy, he would have led a better life. Okay. Object lesson again in the text. Gender is very interesting. The Cambridgeshire Bible, of course. What is your role as a woman? What is your role as a man? Very carefully spelled out. I don't know if any of you have these, the beginner's Bibles, in your homes. You might, because it's really hard to find Bible stories for really young children. And there are lots and lots of stories that start out such and such woman really, really wanted a baby, and she prayed to God, and she got one, and she was so happy. And there, that's how most of the stories of women are in these Bibles. The fun, interesting stuff happens to the boys. There's the story of, you know, the story of David killing Goliath. That's always a really good one. And the story of Moses and the bulrushes. There are so many stories of the important guys in the Bible when they were little boys. And those all make it in here. One of the problems, of course, for children's Bibles, when we're talking about gender, is that there are not as many good stories about girls. And some authors, interestingly, don't mind the story of Esther or other stories, the story of Judith, as much as they could, so they don't get in here. Or also, those stories are kind of complicated and adult, and they're very difficult to tell in a way that would make sense to young children. So it makes it difficult. Also, the male language for God is pretty well preserved in all of these. There are some pretty interesting developments along class lines historically. Interestingly, up until about 1750, the goodness of labor and work was not in children's Bibles. And then in the century from 1750 to 1850, there was a huge class divide in Bibles. In Bibles that were beautifully made, and so therefore expensive, and published for affluent children, work was presented as the punishment for sin, right? When you exit the garden, with the implication there that anyone who was working hard deserves to do so because of something wrong they've done. And I don't know if any of you were here for when I was talking about Jonathan Edwards this week, but Jonathan Edwards said, well, if children are suffering, it must be because they did something wrong. They deserve it. And that's what went into these children's Bibles. If you have to work hard for a living, it's punishment for your sin. Okay? And then in cheap Bibles, there would be excerpts like those ones from the Cambridgeshire Bible that would praise hard work, right? Because you were working class and you were supposed to get out there and use your muscles. And so that was it. After about 1850, that distinction, that class distinction ends, and the texts are pretty much the same. Contemporary texts are tending toward a more ecumenical approach. Up until the last half of this century, you have Protestant children's Bibles and Catholic children's Bibles. And you have American children's Bibles and British children's Bibles and French and Canadian, you know. More and more, these Bibles are put together by international ecumenical commissions. So that when you go to a religious bookstore and you're looking for a children's Bible, you probably won't find incredibly large differences according to the religious background of the publishing house. There still may be divergences, but they won't be due to the religious background of the publishing house so much as the kind of audience the Bible is aimed at, you know, the age group and all of that, and also the date on which it was made. Let's see. For adolescents, we have all these interpretive paraphrases like The Way or Good News, right? But for younger children, we have changes made. And I've talked about Noah's drunkenness, how it was left out. Lot's daughters is often left out nowadays. The Binding of Isaac, I've made such a huge mess out of all these stacks. I hope I can find the one I want. Hold on here. Does it have an interesting version of Binding of Isaac? In one of these. Hold on here. Maybe I use this one. Yeah. And this one has an interesting version of David and Bathsheba, too. Here's the way it's presented. This is kind of a PC children's Bible. If any of you are interested in, if all children's Bibles are interpretive, if you want a children's Bible that asks contemporary questions, and especially kind of feminist ones, you might want to look at this. Although some of its questions are so pointed that when I showed it to a group of of very feminist college women, they thought it was almost funny, and it's hard for them, it's hard for that group to think that anything is too extreme. So you might want to look at it. But here's David and Bathsheba. Since David was the king, he felt he could take anything he wanted, so he sent one of his servants to tell Bathsheba to come to the palace. David made Bathsheba have sex with him, and she became pregnant. Then David decided that he wanted to marry Bathsheba, but she already had a husband, Uriah. Bathsheba didn't like what David was doing, but she had no choice. "I am just a woman," thought Bathsheba. "David is the king." Several months later, Bathsheba gave birth to a baby boy. Okay, this is not the same picture as Bathsheba looking over her shoulder like that. David, very different. Let me see if I can find, I forgot to mark the. Another interesting one is that, fascinatingly enough, very often in the story of Moses, even though Moses' sister has a name in the Bible, what is it? In the story of the childhood of Moses, quite frequently, Miriam is not named. Now, this is very curious because she has a name in the Bible, and yet they leave it out. They just say Moses' sister. And so a child who later reads about the importance of Miriam would not necessarily understand her importance early in the story. And if I have to go a long time before I can find this, let's see. And the story about Abraham and the binding of Isaac, and this one is called Abraham Doesn't Understand. Fascinating, okay. All right, well, let me see if I can find this. Gosh. All right. Now I'm not finding what I thought. There's one of these that says, and he didn't even ask Sarah if he could take Isaac up there. It's not this one, but it's very interesting that gets put in now in some of these. Sarah gets a kind of a voice in some of these that she doesn't have in the biblical text. The other thing about this particular Bible, one of the things that's been left out of a lot of children's Bibles historically, recently, since the taking of sex out of the Bible, is the Song of Songs. This one puts it back in a very pretty, in a fairly explicitly romantic way. And if you look at the words that are chosen, in a lot of children's Bibles where the Song of Songs is, they go through the Song of Songs and they pick out the only parts of the text you could find that are not sexual at all. You know, there are maybe 15 lines, but if you took them out separately, they don't look sexual, and so they put those in. But here again, we have the Song of Songs, and this one is very explicit. It has kisses and caresses and things in it, which is unusual for children's Bibles. Another fascinating one, this is almost Midrash, that is, almost a text written to fill in the blanks in the biblical text. This is called from a book called Jesus for Children. And it doesn't call itself a children's Bible, but it is really kind of the story of the New Testament explained for children. And this is Joseph reacting to the news of Mary's pregnancy. Very interesting. "I know about the baby," said Joseph. "Who told you?" asked Mary. "A stranger. He was standing in my shop. He seemed to know everything." "He sounds like the one who told me." "I'm sorry I got so angry," said Joseph. "That's all right," said Mary. "How do you feel?" "Fine. How about you?" "Not so bad," said Joseph. "Oh, these are for you." He handed her some flowers. "Joseph, I thought you'd never speak to me again." "Do you still want to marry me?" "Hold me, Joseph, I'm afraid." "I still want to marry you," said Joseph. "You're my friend, you laugh at my jokes, you're so beautiful." "We'll name the baby Jesus," said Mary. "Yes, that's the name the angel used," said Joseph. A way of trying to explain the text to fill in the blanks for the child. Right. And there's the picture that goes with it. So that's the end of the piece. So I'm going to turn this off. The younger the target audience, the more the authors are concerned to show God as solely kind and benevolent. God may be fair, but that's about as harsh as it gets. Okay? God loves everybody. God's feelings are hurt when they don't love him back. Okay? And so the stories that show that in the Old Testament especially seem to show God as hard-hearted or as almost unfairly preferring one person to another either get left out or an explanation has to be added in why God would do this thing and why it makes sense even though it seems difficult to understand. What I'm going to do is pass a bunch of these around so that you can look at them. I haven't had as much time to talk about them as I wanted to, but I do want you to get a chance to just flip through some of your favorite stories and see how differently they're handled. And so I'm going to send some on one side and some on another. Just make sure I get the back because a few of them belong in the bookstore, actually.
Can I ask you, of these books for families and children, what is the age range on, like, Miriam's, stories about women in the Bible? Is that for older girls?
That's really for older children, okay. I think. That one I don't know as well.
Okay.
But it's more for older children. One of the ones that surprised me was this older Orbis one, which puts David in Absalom, it leaves out the rape, it just says that Absalom behaved terribly towards Tamar. I mean, Amnon behaved terribly towards Tamar, but at least leaves it in. Here are some other ones. Now, interestingly enough, we think that the concern, by the way, about gender and the stories of the Bible is a new one. Looking through some old children's Bible stories, getting ready for this, found some that if they couldn't put it, would take a very small story from the Old Testament and blow it up, you know, about a girl. And I looked through this book that had six of these expanded stories, and sure enough, three of them were about girls and three of them were about boys. So this concern isn't a new one. Neither is the concern, as you saw, to try to explain Jacob or to correct mistakes, a new one. So this idea of interpreting the biblical text for children and trying to explain it isn't new at all. There is another approach to children's stories, and this was a little bit the case in the one I read about Joseph and the flowers. And it's Midrash. Midrash in the Jewish tradition is a tradition of interpretation in which people try to fill in the blanks in the text, the kind of questions that pop into your head. Well, so why didn't David punish Amnon? You know, or what did Joseph say to Mary when he had to go apologize to her? And there is a contemporary author who lives in Indianapolis who was one of the first female Reform rabbis who does children's books. And two of her very beautiful books are in the bookstore. I encourage you to look at them and maybe take them home. A couple of them are quite frankly Midrash, and I'll pass these around too. These are our copies. This is Nema. This is the story of Noah's wife. And what Eisenberg Sasso does with this one is to say, well, Noah was in charge of putting animals on the ark, but what else was necessary to continue human life on Earth? Food, plants, right? Yeah. And so in this, she writes a midrash on the text in which she gives Noah's wife a name and has her going out for God, collecting seeds, and putting them on the ark. And so when the dove goes to get the olive branch, guess why that olive tree grew? Naamah saved the olive seed and had sent the bird out with it to plant it earlier on. Okay, this is a midrash on the text that helps children imagine the rest of the story, and especially because biblical stories tend to push the women down and not talk about what they were doing, creates a story about a woman who was certainly as important to the success of the trip as Noah. Okay? This is also a book of Midrash that she's done. It's called But God Remembered. This is a slightly more Jewish book in the sense that it takes Jewish Midrashic traditions about women in the Bible and explains them for children. The story of Lilith, which you may know about, there was another woman in the garden, okay, in the story of Adam and Eve, according to the Midrashic tradition. And a number of other stories, Bithya. Okay, because in the Jewish Midrashic tradition, there are biblical women that aren't in the Pentateuch, that are part of the larger tradition. And so this explains them, and if you want to learn about that or have your children learn about that, that's a great book to look at. Other books she's done, this is a book about naming God, and it talks about different names one might give to God depending on one's particular experience of God and how all of these names are good ones and implies that we should use a lot of them rather than only one. One of her great gifts is she uses good illustrators too. This is one of her earlier ones called God's Paintbrush, which helps children imagine things about God. Kind of a neat one. And one that she didn't do, but is also by Jewish Lights, is this one, the 11th Commandment, in which children in a number of different places, a number of different religious organizations were asked what the 11th Commandment ought to be, and then to illustrate their commandment. And it's a wonderful kind of family meditation book. This one, the illustration that I'll pass around, is particularly powerful. Thou shalt not create war at all, and no bombing just for the heck of it. The illustration is really powerful, and I'll pass that around too. These are marvelous books. There are many marvelous books. I encourage you to go over to the bookstore, because three of the books I'm passing around actually came from there. Some of the best biblical stories for children these days are not necessarily in children's Bibles, but they're freestanding books, a book about Daniel, a book about David. One of the most fantastic books, Bill, I'm going to have to ask you to help me. I just dropped his name. The Noah and the Ark book?
Peter Speer.
Peter Speer. Does anybody have books by Peter Speer?
Yeah, no words.
Yes,
oh,
the story of Noah and the Ark. I didn't bring it without words, and it shows Noah mucking out the stalls of the animals.
Oh, my gosh.
What would life really have been like on the Ark? And it's a wonderful imaginative book, usable by children who can't even read, and yet I think it tells the story more convincingly than any book on Noah and the Ark that I have ever read. Terrific book. Any other favorite books that you have or concerns that you have in looking for books for children, things you've found, observations?
Who was the one about David? What was the that couple of books? Are those thicker books for
kids? There are a couple by Lady Bird Press. There's a set of five on Moses, David, Daniel. I forget. They're not here, but they're Lady Bird. I can't remember what we've got here, but I'm just saying that when you're looking for children's biblical stories, sometimes the most beautifully illustrated, satisfying ones come in individual editions, you know, and not necessarily even series, than in these big children's Bibles. So sometimes those are as fulfilling of course, the problem is they're more expensive because you end up buying a lot of them. But sometimes they're also beautifully done and more engaging for a child who's used to a picture book. You know, children's Bibles usually have sort of one picture per story. And those books have a lot of pictures per story. And so for children who like picture books, they're much better. Yes?
How are you going to tell the story of Tower of Babel to children? Tower?
The Tower of Babel? That's an interesting question. And for this talk, I didn't look at those stories in these Bibles, but I think it would be depicted differently. The main depiction in this century, I think, has been that people had pride, right? And their pride led them to this punishment by God. But in a multicultural world, multiple languages don't sound like a bad thing. However, if any of you have those newer ones, if you want to flip to that story and see what they say, that would be great. I don't know if you have them. I don't have, let's see, I've got the toddler's one up here and it may not even be there.
Is this the one you're, one of the newer ones?
Yeah, that's one of the newer ones. And that looks pretty good to me, except that the text is a little bit old-fashioned in its wording.
Have you read Walt Whitman's? I haven't read it for so long. We had it when our kids were younger.
Yeah.
In light of what you're saying, I'm going to be curious to go home and look for it. I'm just curious whether you analyzed it.
He does a pretty traditional, not necessarily in a bad sense, take, but the language is a little still, what we would think of it as stiff. It seems to me that I got that picture of Bathsheba going like this from him.
From him, yeah. his adult Bible is just wonderful.
Uh-huh.
His new, what is it, the stories, I mean, there's Mishra, he's done the Mishra himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful reading in the New Testament, Simeon, the story of Simeon, and his serving a role of the different priests of the different tribes took turns,
uh-huh.
why he was there. Some really interesting Bible reading, just wonderful reading.
And the interesting thing is that his children's Bible is pretty old. It's about, it's over 30 years old, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and
so
I think if he undertook the same project, it might be very different now.
So I'm going to go home and compare them. Thank you. This
yeah.
is great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on text? Yes.
You know, Mark Gallen's book, this guy have a big toe.
Yes. I should have mentioned that one. Does God Have a Big Toe is another one. I think it's by Rabbi Mark Gallen.
Yeah, it's a rabbi. It's all Old Testament stories, but for us in particular, the point of view is so fresh
mm-hmm.
for me, and the kids just love it. And I recall specifically like the first story is the Adam and Eve story, and there's no focus on blaming one person or another
right.
anymore, but that it's the focus is on the growth in the garden, and if they look through a hole in the wall and see this poor little tomato plant suffering mm-hmm. out there, and they make a choice to go out and take care of it, and that's how they got out of the garden.
Very different interpretation. Yeah, that's a good one, and I feel really badly that I didn't mention it. That is a neat one. Very interesting to give new perspective on the text. That one you can just plain order, or I think it's usually listed in the, does anybody get the Chinaberry book catalog?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it might be in that one.
What was the name of it?
Does God Have a Big Toe? By Mark.
I should write another one too, because, maybe there's 10 stories in there.
Right. That's why at once a year I check to see what Sandy Sasso has done, because she does some of the same kinds of things with texts, looking at them from a new perspective. And I think especially Jan Otto and I didn't plan this convergence, but I think looking at the Old Testament stories from a Jewish midrashic perspective can help us find new rationales for them, find new ways of dealing with them. Because they're really tough stories to deal with for children. Very odd.
But
and it helps.
On the other hand, not dealing with them, taking out all the sharp edges, is sort of like what's done to Grimm's fairy tales, and takes all of the spice out of it.
Yes.
And the kids, though, the kids would prefer it left for the most part, I think.
Yes.
Because they have all those little sharp edges themselves.
Right. And the meanings of the stories change. For instance, the Absalom story completely. You take out all the sharp edges. They still may need some softening or interpretation, but the logic sometimes completely shifts if you leave out the chunks that are uncomfortable.
And the fact that they're often isn't, that logic is beside the point, is sometimes left out. And that's very difficult for logical type adults to handle.
Right. The authors of children's Bibles want each story to have a point.
Yes. Nicely tied up.
Yes. And so the points have changed over time. And when you leave only one point in, the other possible points fall out of the picture. I'm aware that we probably, yes.
Where?
Those of you who want to be in line for lunch, we should end. And I'm really grateful for your all coming on a Saturday morning in the chaos of Saturday morning at Holden to share all these books and look at all these pictures. This was actually the most fun for me to do today. So I hope that you enjoyed it as well and that this will expand your reading. And I look also for other recommendations from you. So thanks.
Thank you.